Welcome to the Atom Ventures podcast. My name is Bhairav Patel. I am the CEO co-founder of Atom Ventures, and today I'm here with Sean Shepherd, the founder of GrowthX and GrowthX Academy. Say hello, Sean.
Hello, Sean. Just kidding. Hi, Rob.
But it's great to have you on. Now, there's going to be a lot of things I guess we're going to talk about. Obviously, the GrowthX is one thing, pitching to investors such as yourself. There's quite a range of different topics we'll talk about, so we'll just get straight into it. Firstly, let's tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and how you know your career before you started GrowthX Academy and actually how your journey to starting that.
Sure. 25 plus years as a serial entrepreneur. I've started five companies. I've had three successful exits. All three companies still operate, probably because I'm not involved anymore. also had some very expensive learning experiences along the way, both as a founder and as an investor. And my partners and I founded GrowthX about 7 years ago on the idea that most startups were failing not because they couldn't build products, but because they couldn't build markets. And we had met as serial entrepreneurs turned investors turned frustrated investors because those companies weren't succeeding for those very reasons. So we just set about trying to solve our own problem, and we looked at how venture capital was structured, having raised it several times and having done bootstrap, but never been on the institutional investor side. We didn't really understand the 2 in 20 economic business model of venture the way that we thought. Once we dug into it, we realized that where companies need the most help is where they get the least from venture. And it's because of the unit economics of venture. The 2% management fee is how partners and their staff get paid to help their companies. And when you're at the seed stage, which is when companies need the most help, when they're most fragile, is when they have the least amount of capital, I'm therefore, by venture rules, paid the least amount to care about you. So if I write you a $100,000 check at the seed stage, I'm paid $2,000 a year to care about you. Yeah. There's not a whole lot I can do for you there. Other than make introductions and, you know, the occasional mentor session and say, go get them. and as a result, according to CB Insights, 70% of funded seed stage startups in the Valley fail, and 8 of the top 10 reasons they fail have to do with markets and people, not products and technology. So we hacked venture. We came up with a different structure where we can invest in a company, but once we invest in them, they can apply for our bespoke accelerator program, and we can earn additional equity for the fund by investing fund capital in the labor of a team to help that team, to help that company find product market fit. I call it my market development team that I personally trained and developed this methodology around helping companies find product market fit. And so we can earn up to an additional 5% ownership across three different traction-based milestones. They're very practical and related to traction, not revenue. Helping a company increase its value and get to, either break even or to a higher valuation on the next round. And it worked really well. The failure rate in our fund is in the teens. The scale rate and the return is outsized relative to the Valley. Everybody's fully aligned with the incentive structure. The GPs in the fund love it because they can de-risk the deals. LPs love it because they get their deals de-risked and they get insights on follow-on investment. And we have a proven team to help that company grow. The founders love it because they get to conserve capital by getting expertise and real help and only in exchange for equity. And so everybody wins. That's sort of how it evolved. Then from there, once we realized this was working and we couldn't help every company forever, sooner or later they have to leave the nest. You need to find talented, stage-relevant people that know how to continue that growth effort. And even here in the Valley, there's not a whole lot of people that have stage-relevant experience that are the right fit for working at a company in that 0-1 stage, as Peter Thiel might call it. So we launched GrowthX Academy as a boot camp, looking at the boot camp market and saying, okay, there's a lot of these coding boot camps, but nobody's teaching people how to sell. Nobody's teaching them how to market. No one's teaching them how to apply design thinking principles in a way that really helps move the needle on the market development side of a business. So we launched GrowthX Academy under that model of training really smart, talented adult learners that have already been accomplished in some other field that wanted to work in startups but didn't want to code. And so your average age in there is 28 to 30 years old. And again, they've already got degrees. They've already been successful. They may have been a lawyer. They may have been a doctor. They may have been in real estate. They may have been in retail or finance or you name it. But they want to work in tech. And they want to contribute in a way other than coding. So that's how we launched the Academy. And then with the Academy pedagogy, they work on real projects with real startups, building a real portfolio of experience and understanding where and how they fit into the world. And then the startups get free help. And everybody wins. And now you start to build this ecosystem. And then you add to that a global network of mentors, thought leaders, practitioners, employers in those fields of sales, marketing, and design thinking in the high-tech world. You now have this really awesome community that everyone helps each other and is fully aligned around it. And then that evolved into corporations wanting to get involved because they wanted to feel to be a part of it. They wanted to buy from the startups. They wanted to invest in them. They wanted to use our methodology for product market fit for their own purpose, for launching new digital products when they weren't used to doing it or they didn't have the teams inside that could accelerate product and market development outside of their core business, help them harness disruption. And then startups that we couldn't invest in would approach and say, we care more about your help than your money. How can we pay you for that? Or how can we use the program? And so we launched GrowthX Studios as a way to work with funded startups and scale-ups on product and market development acceleration. So it's become this whole ecosystem. And then the final piece of it is governments and accelerators and incubators and economic development orgs came to us and said, we want you to come open a location where we are. We want the school, we want the accelerator, we want the fund, you know, the corporate innovation work studios, the whole shebang. And we said, yeah, that sounds great, but we're not interested in building a big old organization. Most of us are on the back halves of our careers, not the front half. And we're not interested in this idea of going out and building this people heavy business model. But what if we licensed it, right? And so that's what we started to do. Our first licensing partner was the Malaysian government in concert with one of their top tech entrepreneurs a little more than 2 years ago. And we've been slowly iterating and developing and trying to perfect a model that would work, that would allow the GrowthX ecosystem to be dropped into any market of any size and be there to actually help companies with the things they need most in a way that creates that economic alignment, has a business model attached to it so that you can survive and help more companies, and a framework for executing on growth. Those are the things that are missing from all these ecosystems around the world, Bharath. I travel pre-COVID 80% of the time, going and talking to these governments and to these agencies and to these corps and everybody else and observing. I see the same thing over and over and over again. Everybody's well-meaning. They all want to help, but they're very much driven by public funding, grants, and other things like that to try and support ecosystems and communities. Raising funds is super hard, as you know. Takes a long time. There's a lot that goes into that. So how can you actually, you know, put boots on the ground, so to speak, and start helping right away? And those are the three things I see missing from those ecosystems. So my hope is by 2021, we're going to be more aggressive in kind of going out to the world and saying, hey, here's a Silicon Valley in a box offering that you can drop into your community and stop losing your top talent to the Valley because they think they have to be here when they could be home to their customers and their families.
So this is very interesting because all of this really resonates with me and what I've seen in the past few years. So with Atom Ventures, so, you know, I've come from a background working at large corporations and then startups and companies where, you know, where we've raised a lot of money and previously and grown quite well. And then with Atom Ventures, what we saw, and the reason that we started Atom Ventures was because we saw that was pretty terrible advice going out there from a tech perspective to a lot of companies, bad strategic and operational tech advice. And having the background that we had in high growth startups, multinational businesses, multinational startups, we wanted to try and give, you know, operational and strategic advice from people who'd actually done it before, right? So we've been there.
Yes.
That. And one of the things that I've seen since I've come back to the UK, and I agree with you, I've been to many of the different accelerators, I won't name names, and incubators, and they're either led by kids or they are led by people who've maybe done one thing, and they've done one thing in one small industry, and they're trying to use the piece of knowledge they gained in that one industry to cover startups across a wide remit of industries and sectors. And so when I, you know, we're lucky in AdAdventures in that we're working with early stage seed businesses across different sectors, but because we're working with them all regularly, we get to see what's going on in those industries. And so I think that gives us that wide spread of knowledge and cross-pollination of ideas from one sector to another. But you know, this is kind of a bit off topic of where I wanted to go, but one of the questions I want to ask you is that as you grow as an academy, how do you maintain the quality? Because, you know, as you said, you guys all have experience, but you're coming at the back end of your career. You don't really want to be in the nitty gritty every day. But as you kind of have these licensed franchisees, or whatever you want to call them, out licensees out there, how do you ensure that kind of quality remains?
Well, it's all about the people. It's all about the people that you select and attract to attend your programs. And it's the people that teach the programs and the people that teach them how to teach the programs. Very early in my career, we talked about it offline, but I was the youngest director of instruction in the world's largest golf schools when I was pursuing a golf career before I moved into tech. And what made them the greatest was their consistency. Anywhere you went in the world, and at one point I think they had 40 plus locations across the globe, you could get the identical experience. And it all had to do with training, and it all had to do with constant reinforcement, and it all had to do with high quality individuals that shared your worldview and your values, beliefs, and shared that common purpose around what you're doing. The academy is not a factory. It's never been a factory. We've always been very low volume and high quality because we don't want to put people into the market that don't meet our brand. So we look for people who've already demonstrated success and ambition in different areas of their life. Like I said, many of them come in with doctorates or master's degrees or 10, 20 years of work experience equivalent. And they have a very specific passion or idea of a passion around wanting to work in tech and figuring out how they can contribute. So we help them translate those skills. And then the community sort of polices itself. People take care of each other. They call each other out. They give back before they get. And it's very much that pedagogy of our approach. And it's, again, it was just sort of born out of this need, right? Colleges don't teach these things.
Sure.
Universities don't teach these things. You get them through direct experience or from corporate, training as an employer and employee, or going through all the failures and learnings yourself. And it's only failure if you don't learn. But that's how we try to maintain that quality, is just with constant reinforcement and very clear structure around programs and selecting the right people and continuing to support them.
So one of the things I've seen recently, I mean, we've had a number of we work with mainly seed startups, right? So one of the interesting things that I find is around product market fit, but also finding that market. And a lot of people come to us wanting to build something. They want to build an app, or they've got a new algorithm they want to sell, or whatever it is. And when you actually start questioning them about the business, because we always believe that the technology strategy follows a business strategy, right? You can't just go out and build. Yep. And a product is not, an app is not a product. It's not a, building an app is not a business in itself. So if you don't know how that, what your business is going to be, then you can't really build that tech. You know, what would you say to people that have, you know, a lot of people are going to be made redundant now. Some people have some money coming out of it. They'll think, hey, let me go and start a business. What would you say to these guys now that may be sitting on a bit of cash and thinking, well, let me go and there's no jobs out there. Let me go and start something.
Well, number one, identify a problem that has real value attached to it. So, and I just did this whole series of webinars on this very topic for corporates on how to drive innovation now. And another series on how to generate revenue now if you're a startup or even a traditional sales professional trying to figure out how to deal with this quote-unquote new normal. But the first thing is to orient yourself around a person and a problem. At the end of the day, everything begins and ends with H2H, the human-to-human experience. Don't think about business models like business-to-consumer, business-to-business, or marketplaces, or B2B2C, or hardware, software, or product or service. Think about everything as an H2H experience. My entire methodology is designed to address the dynamic of what it is to take something someplace new, whether it's an existing thing to a new place or a new thing to an existing place or a new thing to a new place. And it's all designed to help you learn three things: the truth about where your product fits in the market, and what to do about it, if it does at all. The second is to create a functional learning organization of the team responsible for pursuing that truth so that they do it as quickly and efficiently as possible, knowing that you have limited time, money, and resources to do it. And the third is to find a freaking business model. Can you find something that's predictable, profitable, and potentially scalable, or at least the indications thereof? And if you ask the right questions in the right order and engage in the right activities with your market or customer segments within that market, you will get your answers, especially if you take that right approach. But the dynamic is very different than what people think. I like to use the analogy that when you're doing this as a founder, you are a stranger in a strange place with a strange offering, going to other strangers and asking them to do strange things with you.
Yeah.
And that's a very different dynamic than when it's a known and a familiar face and a familiar product or a familiar brand or a familiar market. And so you have to, it requires a different approach. So step one, orient yourself around a problem that you can solve, that you think you can solve really well, even if you can't do it with your product yet. Most of our most successful founders, especially in the SaaS community, were all service providers first. I wrote an article on this called Why SaaS Should Be Called Services as a Software, Not Software as a Service. Because the most successful SaaS founders were performing those tasks as a service provider or in a manual way long before they started to build automation around it. But it's not the tech that wins, Rob. It's the insights that you have, right? And it's about solving somebody's problems. So no one cares about our products. They care about their problems and whether or not they can be solved. So go out and find a problem that you can solve really well. The best EIRs in the Valley, when they sell a company and they go back into a fund and they're paid a stipend to hang out and look for the next thing, what are they actually doing? They're out there talking to leaders about their biggest challenges that they have now and will have for the next 5 to 10 years before they do anything. So that's where you start. You start with a problem and a person, and then you define a use case together, and then a measurable value hypothesis that you can test against. And you do all this shit before you build anything. And then through the course of that, you can learn what's monetizable and what's not. And then build out from there. But start by inventorying your ideas and then prioritizing them based on the need in the market. If you don't have differentiation, if there's no need in the marketplace, there's no compelling reason for anybody to change and work with you versus what they're currently doing. Because your competition's in some other company. It's change the resistance to change.
It's funny actually, because I think you and I have a very similar outlook on that. I recently did a webinar where we were talking about creating a tech strategy for your business. And I was asked the question as to, do we need to create a mobile app? Do we need to create a web app? And I said, well, you know, most companies I speak to, can you do it on paper before you start building the technology? Can you, because you'll know then if you've got a service that's worth, you're providing, that actually solves an issue that's out there in the marketplace. You can build the technology whenever you need to in order to kind of solve whatever they are, whether it's process issues, language issues, whatever it is you need to solve, the technology can solve those issues. But firstly, you've got to figure out, is this something that people want and can you do it? And if you can do it without technology, then you know there's a business there, right? And that's something
that you can build upon. If you're uncomfortable talking to humans, then you need to get uncomfortable, or you need to get a partner who's comfortable. And I can't overstate that enough. I mean, one of our investment philosophies is we don't typically invest in solo founders unless they've been successful as a solo founder in the past, because you need someone on the market side to complement the product side. And so we find great product focused founders that openly say, in a very humble way, I don't know what I don't know yet about markets and the market development side of this. Because at this stage, what you don't know is more important than what you do. And so the whole MXP framework is designed to ask the right questions in the right order, the most efficient way possible to get you to that truth that we talked about. And then culturally, you have to functionally learn from that, find those patterns, and then you start to build against that. But you do it in a very focused and objective way that says, we call it setting your first market milestone. We have product milestones on the tech side, right? Everybody knows what a product milestone is. But nobody talks about market milestones. So who are the first three customers that I want to test and validate this with? And what does the proof of concept look like? How do we define it? How do we measure it? What do I need for my customer side, not just my side? Because you don't need revenue right now. I know it's hard for people to accept that. What you need is people's time and their truth.
Yeah.
And if you get their time and their truth, that will lead to the learning. It'll be up to you to learn from that and pivot accordingly into a deep problem that you can solve really well in a market that's big enough for you to go out and raise money against if you want to raise against it. And you'll have three raving fan referenceable customers on which to do that. Because traction always speaks louder than words. And especially now, in the age of applied technology, where it's never been easier or cheaper to get products to market, it's also never been more difficult or expensive to get traction for them in the market because there's so much noise. Mm-hmm. And so I look and we look for people who've demonstrated they can do what I just laid out. And then if they can do that, that speaks volumes about what a quality founding team you might have and what they know how to do and how to do it. And those are the kinds of people we like to back.
So how much of this philosophy did you wish you had when you first started your first business?
All of it. I mean, but that's what it comes, right? There's that joke of experience is what you get when you don't get what you want, right?
Yeah.
And I've got now 28 years of this. And it's really, like I said, just been in the last 7 or 8 years now being outside of it and being on the investor side, I had a chance to get the frog out of the well, if you will, and take a broad look at the ocean and see people like myself, almost an out of body experience with a group of entrepreneurs. And I go, I've seen that movie before.
Right.
I know what's going to happen if you do this. And I know what's going to happen if you don't do that. Right. And so now how do we build a framework for you to operate where you avoid all of the pit, just the stupid stuff. And really what it comes down to is the allocation of the limited resources that you have. You're usually one or two or three people, you're self-funding, or you've got a little bit of friends and family money or grant or whatever else. You don't have a lot of resources. And every minute you're spending with talking to the wrong people is a minute you're not spending talking to the right people. And that learning curve just gets longer, right? And the trough on the J curve just gets deeper. And can you survive it? So I like to say, you know, my wife's British and we have a home in London. And I always say, can you be on the pitch long enough to learn?
Right.
And that's half the battle, is staying on the pitch. So my partner, Will Bunker, who started the world's largest online dating site, what you know now is Match.com, did it with $90,000. Seed capital from his boss and never had to raise another dime and grew that thing 30% month over month for 5+ years before he sold it to Barry Dillard Interactive. And he did it in Dallas, Texas in the 1990s at a time in the Bible Belt when people would literally back away from him in shame when he told them what he did for a living, which was just try to solve for loneliness. There's a lot of funky, weird stories inside of that, but they had a very simple philosophy in their office, and it was on the whiteboard every day, and everybody's actions were driven by this very simple statement: most money, least work. What can I do today to generate the most revenue with the least amount of time, money, effort, and resources? And so I've adopted that, but in a little bit different way, which is most learning, least work. So how can I learn? Because if you believe what I believe, learning leads to the revenue. But you have to be in that learning mode and have to have that open growth mindset that says, I don't know what I don't know yet. Feedback is a gift. Lay it on me. Is there a problem here for you or not? Just because I think there's one doesn't mean you believe it. And is that problem big enough to create an impact that's great enough to demonstrate that I actually have a need that I have to raise my hand and go, I need to do something about this? And that's the difference. And that, so if I went back to my 21-year-old self or my 19-year-old self, that's what I would say. Find fit. Go recruit early partners who share your vision and respect your reality and are willing to go on that journey with you. Don't try and sell ideas to people. But in order to do that, you've got to get clear about what you think the problem is and how that problem can get solved. And then go have those conversations. And do that all before you build anything. You'll save a shit ton of time, money, and resources.
And stress.
And then the last thing I would say, as always, is my father used to tell me, my father was a captain of industry here in Silicon Valley. He was a He grew up in Intel and became a big, he was a chief operating officer there for years, worked directly for Andy Grove. The stories are incredible. He was a turnaround CEO of many semiconductor companies. And sadly, he passed away last year, 1 year ago today, in fact, at the young age of 67, due to cancer that just kind of struck him quickly and silently. But he would always say to me, you know, trust your gut. Just trust what your body is telling you about people and about situations and about circumstances. And you will be fine. And I look back on my career and I would say that where I struggled the most is when I went against that gut feeling. I would over intellectualize or overthink, a feeling. Ignore the experience that my body was having, and then I'd frustrate myself and my purpose. And so I would say that that's the number one thing I would say to people. That plus, don't fall in love with products and ideas, but fall in love with people. And if you can do that, products and ideas are everywhere, but great people are really hard to find. You know, Bill Hewlett and Bob Packard started HP. Those guys went to Stanford together and they spent 5 years after school before they actually launched any kind of product or built anything. Didn't even know what they were going to do. They just knew they were going to do it together because they had the same worldview, the same values, and the same sort of vision for what they wanted to do with their lives. And then they didn't care what the product was.
It's interesting you mentioned that actually, because when I talk to US investors, it's a very different mindset, let's say, than the UK investors. US investors always said to me that they'd rather they have a great team with a bad idea than a great idea with a bad team. And they're much willing to back the team because they know the team will figure a way out at some point.
Did you watch that documentary recently about Magic? And I grew up here in the Valley, so I remember Magic, which was the big Apple spinoff trying to create, essentially the first smartphone back in the early 90s, late 80s.
No, I didn't see that.
Fantastic. I can't remember the name of it now, but it was the team that they assembled around trying to essentially create what we now know as, the smartphone and the iPhone in the 80s, all went off after that thing failed to massive success. One of them founded Nest, just so many, because they were a great team. Like you said, a great team with a great idea that's time had not yet come. And market timing is one of the primary reasons companies fail. When you ask Bill Gross of Idea Labs, who's probably the most successful startup incubator studio in the history of independent one anyway, in the history of the Valley, when he goes back and looks at the number one component of the for each of his successes, he says it's all about timing in the marketplace.
That's probably the hardest though, right? Out of anything else, pretty much everything else you said, you can plan for in some way or another, right? You can figure out who's a great person in your team. You can go and talk to people. Timing is a killer though. I mean,
timing's tough. It requires you to have that ability to see the forest through the trees, right? That Jerry Seinfeld like observation acumen, as I call it. It's like Jerry Seinfeld makes things that you and I do and see and experience every day funny as hell, because we go, oh my God, that's hilarious. I never thought about it that way. I never even considered that was a thing, but it is a thing and you identify with it. And so the visionaries can do that. So can you step outside yourself and outside of a situation and rise to a level where you can see through the forest through the trees? Like I said, it took me becoming an investor and not an operator to be able to do that for myself and recognize that the problem I was trying to deal with my portfolio of companies was a problem that exists for every portfolio of companies to some extent. And that's back to your comment about accelerators and incubators. I just want to say one thing about all of them. I love them all. I appreciate that they all exist. I totally support their mission. And I think that they are incorrectly focused on product development and raising money when they need to be focused on market development and making money. That's my comment on those things. And there are 10,000 of them around the world. I'm hoping that they're going to start to see that balance or try to achieve that balance of market development and money making.
That's, again, interesting you raise that point, because, again, I think very much in the same way as you. I was, so for one of our clients, I was taking part in an accelerator incubator for, I just flew over to Israel for a few days. But what I noticed there was that every hour they're pitching. So every hour that someone's doing a pitch contest, or you have to refine your pitch. And so in those 3 months, I think they probably worked on their own businesses and they didn't even come out with a business plan, right? So, I mean,
And you ask the founders, why do they join these accelerators? Because they want to get access to capital. I mean, and that's fine, but that's not the only thing. And I mean, not 50% of these plus aren't even venture capable businesses. No. And no one's telling them that. Because venture, if you want to raise venture, you have to understand the business model of venture. Otherwise, you're going to struggle, right? Venture is designed for 10x returns or greater. And if you can't build a $100 million business, nobody's going to be interested. And so you don't have to build a $100 million business to be a successful entrepreneur. I mean, you can deliver value to your community, take care of your family and your employees and their families and their communities, and be incredibly successful. I don't care if you own a convenience store or a pub. It doesn't matter. But these people are all so obsessed and romanticized around the idea of what Silicon Valley is and what this whole thing looks like. And they don't want to be the next Mark Zuckerberg, or they watch Silicon Valley on HBO and they think this is where they need to go. They just need a little bit more perspective, I would say.
Well, I mean, I've said this ever since I got involved with, at least back in the UK, when I've got involved with business here, you know, and I say, the guy who owns a barbershop, he's an entrepreneur, right? The guy, my dad, who started a newsagent's convenience store, he's an entrepreneur. And their businesses weren't multi-million, but they put a roof over your head and you know, you got a cardboard out of it. And that's, you know, yes, everyone wants to be a millionaire, but you've got to lose sight of the fact you've got to build the business first. And then it's got to be valuable enough that people will give it that kind of price tag.
What does Simon Sinek say? Everybody wants to be on the mountaintop, but nobody wants to climb it.
Yeah, exactly.
You want to be dropped from a helicopter. That's not how it works. You have to want it to be, you have to want to be in this journey. You know, the successful entrepreneur is the first one to show up, the last one to leave, and the last one to get paid. And no one ever talks about that or celebrates that. Then they see one day that you've been successful and they think it was overnight. Bullshit.
Well, yeah, this is a thing that I find quite interesting as well. You'll see people always cite the Airbnb stories or whatever it is, but you know, these guys spent years building up that base and getting the first 1,000 bookings. It took years to do that.
That's right. Well, it was 2007, 2008. I mean, incubating the idea for years prior to that. So here we are 10, 11, 12 years later, and people think it's an overnighter. It's not. Every overnight success story takes years.
So you mentioned something interesting about pitching to VCs. Now, obviously, you and I deal with more seed level businesses. How do you pitch to angel investors in seed? What should you be doing there?
As an entrepreneur who's pitching raise?
Yeah, exactly. If you're pitching to raise to someone at the seed.
We teach our MXP program. We apply to investors the same way we apply to customers, because again, it's all human to human. So the first thing you have to do is develop an ideal investor profile. Right. And you have to think about who invests in your vertical or your industry, your product, your market, who invests at this stage. Right. What's their track record look like? And start building a list and a profile of these people. What do they like? What do they care about? What do they look for? They're very public about it. People write and share all the things they look for. So you just have to do that research. So that's the first thing. The second thing I would say just generally about venture as a whole is the very first round is always friends and family. People are going to invest in you because they love you, not because of what you're doing. And there's nothing wrong with that. But don't go to institutional money if you don't have revenue. You're just not going to anymore. In the age of applied technology, people are not investing in ideas unless you're a horse that's won in the past. Mm. So you need to show real traction. And that traction can take maybe not the form of revenue, but very close to it. Maybe it's free users acquired, and you've got a plan to convert them, and you can show how you're going to convert them from free to paid, for example. Even if you have service-based revenue that shows that people want you to solve their problem, then eventually you're going to use that service-based revenue to build deeper relationships, get longer contracts, and build automation so that you can create fatter margins, you know, on the upside down the road. That's fine too. I love great professional services organizations that pivot into automation because, as I said earlier, they understand it. So know that friends and family are people who are going to invest in you first. And then after that, you're looking at things that are usually government funded or publicly funded, like accelerators and incubators and economic development organizations. And then you're looking at seed stage, which typically happens once you're starting to get into some real recurring revenue with a few early customers. Like for us, you know, if you're not pushing somewhere around 500K in ARR, you know, it's just not, you're not there yet.
Right.
And that's on the SaaS side for recurring revenue. So you need to know exactly the criteria. Every venture capitalist will tell you their criteria and publish it somewhere. So don't just start reaching out to people. Then after that, you've got to build a really strong positioning and narrative, right? How do you position yourself in the marketplace? And then what's the narrative? And that narrative is your why, okay? This is why I'm doing what I'm doing, because there's been this fundamental shift somewhere in the market that's created an opportunity for change here. And here's how I'm planning to solve it. So it's a very clear definition of the problem, the shift, and the solution, right? The opportunity created by that shift, and then the solution. And then it's team, model, markets, right? And then ask. So tell me about your team. Tell me about your business model. Tell me about the size of your market and the opportunity that exists with it. And tell me about what you're raising and why and how and where you are. And keep that simple. And that's and then everything else goes into an appendix. I don't want to see a pitch deck longer than 12 slides, personally. So, and never forget, if somebody chooses to pass on you, it's not because your idea isn't good. It's because they're looking at 1,000 other things and your stack ranked out. And so don't take that stuff personally. Learn from it. Walt Disney went to some 80 different banks to try and fund his theme park. And by then he was already a successful filmmaker and cartoonist, and everybody thought he was crazy. And as he walked out of every meeting, he said, I know you may not be interested in seeing me again, but if you were, what could I have done differently in this meeting to get your interest? And he collected all that feedback and he used that to continue to improve his pitch until he finally got a bank to back him.
Yeah, I think the learning experience, I think that's one of the people, either learning experience, but also be people, I think they take it personally. Well, of course they take it personally because it's their own business, right?
Personally, we say we want information, but we really want affirmation. And that's the difference between a fixed mindset and a growth mindset, right? You need to be open to that learning. You need to say the feedback is a gift. And you really need to take it to heart and look for the patterns that exist across that feedback and make those adjustments. Otherwise, you're not going to grow. I mean, everybody who's raised money, it's no different than selling. You fill a funnel with your prospects that meet that investor profile, and you start working it. Jeff Bezos had to talk to whatever it was, 60 guys to raise his first $1 million, and Gates had to talk to several hundred. And back then, Bezos even tells a story that people were asking him not about why he's selling books online, but what is this internet thing you're talking about? So, I mean, that's literally the kind of stuff that you have to deal with. And then it becomes a numbers game once you learn from that.
So I realized I haven't actually asked you any questions that I was intending on asking you. We just got in there completely different direction, which is great. But one thing I definitely want to get out of the way now while we can is a little bit more about GrowthX Academy. I mean, I've seen you've got some fantastic resources online. Are you present in London? How do people get involved with you if they want to apply?
Yeah, now they can leverage. No, so we don't have an office there. Like I said, my wife is from there. We have a home in Esha.
Ah.
What's going on? But I do envision a day where we have a presence there. But in the meantime, you can do it all virtually. You can go to growthx.com and go to the GXMXP series, which stands for GrowthX Market Acceleration Program, and subscribe and read. There's an article for every step in the milestone, in the three milestones of the Market Acceleration Program. There's all the tools and resources associated with it. If you just Google me, you can see the speeches and the podcasts and the talks and the conversations. All the content is out there for entrepreneurs. And then GX Academy. .com is where you can learn about the curriculum if you're looking or interested in working in non-tech roles in tech companies and get some upskilling and reskilling there. And then corporates, of course, can reach out to us for innovation work. Funded startups can reach out to us for studio work. They can email me directly. I'm happy to, or they can follow me on LinkedIn, connect with me there at Sean A. Shepherd on Twitter, Sean at growthx.com.
So actually one thing I want to touch on there is around corporates. And you know, corporates are horrendously bad at innovating in many ways, right? So when you're working with corporates, do you have to teach them a little bit of how to work with startups? Do you actually have to kind of say to them, like, this is a different world that you're into, and teach them and guide them?
Yeah, you want to talk about one of the leading cause of deaths of startups, it's corporates. because they have a different decision-making cycle, a different timeline, a different set of resources, a different set of priorities. And one of the first things we teach our startups is to understand what their customer lifecycle and acquisition strategy is going to be, and what a really good fit early customer looks like, and what a bad fit one looks like, so that they stay away from those scenarios. And then we teach corporates the same thing on the open innovation side. But also, their failure rate of innovations is higher than that of funded startups. Mm. Over 90% fail to last more than 3 years in a market. And it's not because they're not well-meaning, once again, but the entrepreneurs and the innovators that started those businesses aren't there anymore. They're dead or retired. And they've hired and created organizations and teams that are fantastic at standardization and optimization, not creation. And so they have a very different set of principles and mindset. It's like you talked about at the very beginning with you and Adam Ventures, right? You know, we're both kind of born and raised in the startup world. And we have those experiences. Very few corporations have anybody who has that kind of experience. And so we try to come in as a tiger team or a special operations team, if you will, help them select the next big idea to work on, or take over one that they've been struggling with, and then do product and market acceleration to learn where it fits, and then find profitability, and then continue to iterate on that. And then we will help them identify, train, and support talent that can come in and operate under our framework, and become self-empowered. So we will do it for them, we will do it with them, and or we will teach it to them. It just depends on what those needs are. And it works very well.
Yeah, I think what I've seen with corporates, obviously the risk issue is there. You know, they're much more risk averse, but it's also that they kind of seem to dampen down and kill the ideas. The initial enthusiasm that comes initially with working with a small startup then just dies after a couple of years.
And you say risk averse, I guess it's all relative, right? Because the amount of money they dump into these ideas is astronomical relative to what would be raised on the open market in venture. Mm. And so I don't know how low risk it really is, but you're right. The minute an innovation starts, so a couple of big problems, right? The first is that there's no dedicated resources to any of these innovations typically. It's shared resources. People have a different set of goals, objectives, they're measured in a certain way. Then they start working on the side on a particular project and they get all excited about it. But the minute they run into challenges, they stop managing the innovation, they start managing their career, and they back into the bushes like Homer Simpson, and they pretend like the damn thing never happened.
Yeah.
and then that whole process begins anew with somebody else, and now you're playing whack-a-mole with your innovations and nothing's actually getting done.
So I guess, as I said, we've kind of not covered many of the topics that I wanted to cover, but there is one question I have to ask you, which is always the last question of any podcast. We've kind of touched on it a little bit, but if you could go back in time 20 years and give advice to your younger self, what advice would you give yourself?
I would, once again, always trust your gut, focus on the problem, not the product, work with people as opposed to ideas, and focus on learning and executing against the learning, and be buoyant and open to the idea of that most of what you take to market is wrong, and your goal is to be a little less wrong tomorrow than you were today. And then ultimately pursue things that create meaning in your life, not happiness. And I think that's another big problem that we have in society today is people are chasing happy. Happy is fleeting and it's very transactional, I think. I think meaning matters much more. I think meaning is what gets you through the hard times. And meaning can be what's good for you, is good for your family and your community, at large. The World Economic Forum is calling this period we're about ready to go into, that are going into, they've just released a whole report on it called The Great Reset. And it's fascinating because it's an opportunity for all of us not just to rethink everything about ourselves, but reset our priorities in a way that we can maybe ultimately line up our economic desires with our environmental desires and our social desires as individuals and as organizations and as teams and society at whole, as a whole, and realign everything so that we get it right this time. We're starting to do a bunch of great reset work around that idea. So those are the things that I would say to my 20-year-old self. And don't be, you don't choose to be an entrepreneur. It chooses you. And you should embrace that. Nothing wrong with being a crazy person.
That's true. Thanks for that. It's been very, very interesting. I think there's a whole bunch of other podcasts we could come off the back of what you just said there, actually. But
we could do more of these. Absolutely. That was great.
We'll leave it for now. Thanks a lot for that, Sean. It's been great hosting you.
Thanks, Bhairav. I've really enjoyed it.